Hello, everyone, and welcome to the second episode of the new season of the Stats for Lefties podcast. In this episode, I talk to Green Party councillor Chris Jarvis of Oxford City Council about the Green Party, the political left in Britain, our respective political journeys, and more. First half of our conversation, which focuses on specific questions, is available here. If you want to hear the full conversation, we're a bit more relaxed and it's a little bit more fun, you can sign up to patreon.com/leftystats from £2 a month, and you get the extra content there. Now, it's a very exciting day because we have with us today Chris Jarvis, Green Party councillor in Oxford, will be known to many on the left, perhaps not by name, as the person who defeated Luke Akehurst in a council election. And for those of you who don't know, Luke Akehurst is a member of the Labour Party's National Executive on the right wing of the Labour Party, and he is a sort of a boogeyman figure for the Labour left. He's sort of like the definition of the Labour right. He's like the symbolic leader of the Labour right. And of course, he holds formal power within the Labour Party by being on the National Executive, which he was in the past, lost his seat, came back, won it again. Chris Jarvis defeated him. So why don't you tell us about that, Chris? What was it like to run against the boogeyman of the Labour left?
Yeah, I mean, I guess on the one hand, you know, it was running that election, it wasn't particularly different from any other local election campaign in one sense. You know, local elections, you know, you're putting forward a series of positions on, you know, how you think your local area or your city should be run. It's often on, you know, hyper-local issues, which, you know, sometimes can be stripped of some of the ideological backgrounds of national politics or wider politics. And, you know, there's not loads of hustings. Local media is covering in Oxford 24 wards, so it doesn't have the time to go into the details of individual sort of races. So you don't necessarily see much of the other candidate. You don't necessarily interact with them that much. This wasn't especially different from that. So in many ways, it was similar to any local election that there would have been. But I think for me, it was different in two ways. The first of which I think was quite a personal one, which is that, you know, every election that I've ever been involved in, whether it's me standing for election in local elections, in student union elections, or whatever it is, or campaigning for other people, there's a point and a moment at which you doubt the utility of what you're doing. And you get to the point where you go, Jesus Christ, I've been knocking on thousands of doors. I've been bitten by dogs, putting leaflets to people's letterboxes. I've had the door slammed in my face. I've been shouted at. And it can get very draining. But you often have to find something to make you carry on and keep going. And now normally it's relatively straightforward for me. You know, it's that, you know, I genuinely believe that the Green Party's vision and politics and values will be genuinely transformative if, you know, all the stars were to align and we take over a council or get an MP elected or whatever it is. But even if it's just a couple of people getting elected, having that accountability and making smaller wins on the way can be really, really valuable as well. But in this instance, personally, it became much easier to motivate myself, knowing that the person that I was up against, you know, represented a kind of toxic, damaging politics that, you know, I've been fighting against, you know, all my adult life. And it became very, very much easier to go out and go, no, this is really important. Not only the things that I believe in are we fighting for, but we're also seeking to stop someone that I think would be damaging getting elected. The reality was that we were knocking on doors in that election and we were getting Labour members and supporters, people that we knew to be Labour members and supporters, people with Labour posters in their window, couldn't stomach voting Labour with Luke Akehurst as the candidate. We had, you know, in some instances, Labour members under the cover of darkness delivering leaflets for myself and the other Green candidate to stop Luke Akehurst getting elected. The compliance unit is always watching. And we also had, you know, dozens and dozens of residents that would say to us on the doorstep, you know, I don't want to vote for Luke Akehurst because of his views on various issues, actually mostly on international issues, his position on things like Palestine, on Saudi Arabia, on the arms trade. I think, you know, in local elections normally, when you're campaigning, you want to spend all of your time trying to, you know, build your profile, to get name recognition. In this instance, the more people that knew about Luke Akers, the less people wanted to vote for him. And so it made our work a lot easier. So I guess, yeah, it was winning that election was, you know, was doubly sweet on the one hand, because, you know, the stuff that I've now been able to do as a councillor, but also on the other hand, knowing that the alternative would have been much, much worse. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I am no longer the Labour Party, so I can say face to face now, congratulations. That's a very excellent thing that you won, for both because it's you and because of who your opponent was, mainly because it's you. The Green Party, obviously, in Oxford is growing, as it is in it is nationally. You've been a member of the Green Party for a long time. I think going on like you were there when I joined already, so well over 10 years, right?
Yeah, I joined the day after the 2010 general election.
So oh, damn.
12 years now.
It's been going through a lot of changes recently. Had got a new deputy leader. It's regularly gaining huge numbers of council seats. Amazingly, came very close to winning the Bristol mayor. Like, I'm glad they got rid of it. Like, mayors are bad. But also, Greens nearly won. And that would have been really, really interesting. But alas.
I think it gives you an indication of the nature of Green politics and the Green Party, right? In that that was the... one position with a pretty big chunk of power that we nearly took, and yet in the referendum we actively campaigned to abolish that position, which I think is a good indication of kind of our values and our approach to politics.
Although, having said the, it may be easier for the Greens, I think, to win a council majority under first past the post and then put the leader in that way than to get the... Well, actually, no. I was going to say 50% plus. But the Tories got rid of that electoral system, didn't they? So the question is, do you think, with all this that's going on, that the Greens are on the verge of a major breakthrough?
It's a really interesting question. And I think...
Obviously, I'm sure many people
ask
it a lot.
Yeah, people do ask it a lot. And people have been asking it, you know, for the entire time that I've been in the Green Party and for many years before that. I think what I'd say is that, you know, politics at the moment is incredibly volatile. You know, our system has, you know, experienced major shock after major shock after major shock, from, you know, the financial crisis of 2007-8 to austerity to Brexit to COVID, the war in Ukraine, you know, the death of the head of state, the climate crisis and so on. So I think, you know, making cast iron predictions, you know, is a fool's game. You know, the odds of Jeremy Corbyn becoming leader of the Labour Party were lower than the odds of Leicester City winning the Premier League. They both happen to do it in the same year, but that gives you an indication of how, you know, unpredictable politics can be. But what I would say is that the conditions we're now experiencing are incredibly fertile ground for the Greens. And what we experience right now in terms of the challenges we face as a country and as a world, my view is that the Green Party has never been as needed as it is right now. So when I say the conditions I think are right, what I mean by that is, you know, we're in a situation now where millions of people don't know how they're going to pay their energy bills over the winter, with a wholly inadequate support package from the government. You know, you've got a generation of people, our generation, that came through, came of age after the financial crash, that experienced the trebling of tuition fees, you know, the scrapping of EMA, a broken jobs market, decimated public services, you know, a private rented sector that is robbing them blind, and so on and so on. You've got the climate crisis that in the UK, people are feeling very, very keenly with the heat waves and the droughts that we experienced over the summer, or they're seeing, you know, their friends and family overseas who are experiencing it, you know, with most recently with the floods in Pakistan being just the latest example. And alongside that, you've got a burgeoning wave of civil society and labour movement resistance to all of those things. Now, all those conditions, I think, leads to millions of people who want an alternative. And when you've got a government which is advocating and exacerbating the status quo, pushing for, you know, even more reactionary policy measures when it comes to things like labour rights and so on, and you've got a Labour Party that spends virtually all of its time saying nothing, and when it does say something, you know, it's pushing to attack trade unions or to advocate for privatisation of public services, there is a massive political space for the Greens to occupy. And it's abundantly clear to me that, you know, in England at least, it's only the Greens that offer that alternative. And I think that those conditions are very ripe for us. Now, you could look at that and say, well, that's largely the same conditions that we had in the Miliband years. You had a Labour party that was adrift from, its roots, its base, and was triangulating on everything it could get its hands on. And people started turning towards the Greens, and they did. But we didn't capitalize on that. And the reason why I think that now is different to then, I think there's two big reasons on top of what I've already said. The first of which is you have a huge group of people who were politicalized, were radicalized, and were given hope by the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn, who have been completely disenfranchised and let down and frustrated by the Labour Party under Keir Starmer. You yourself are one of them, and many of the people listening to this will be amongst that number too. And so you have millions of people who were offered hope, were told that it was possible, and had their hopes dashed. We can offer that hope. The second thing I think is that the Green Party of 2022 is very different to the Green Party of 2012. The party is five times the size of what it was then. The our inability, our disorganisation, our campaigning experience, that's been shed. We're now in a position where we're regularly winning elections very effectively. I mean, you just look every Thursday, you look at what happens on by-election day, and the Greens gain a seat pretty much every other week at the moment. And on top of that, I think what you've got is, you've got a wide range of very talented, very experienced people from the top to the bottom of the party. So I think, in short, to answer your question, yes, I do think the Greens could be on the verge of a major breakthrough. I think if not now, then will it ever happen? I personally think it will, but obviously notwithstanding what I said earlier about how the fact that it's basically impossible to predict anything at the moment. So I guess what does that look like? I mean, to me, it looks like over the next few years, us continuing to make major, major gains in local elections, gains of on a bigger scale than we've seen in recent years. Greens entering administration in local councils across the country, in other places. In Oxford, doubled the number of councillors we had. We went from three to six. In the future, we're going to be looking at double-digit seats in Oxford, and I do think that we're going to be seeing more Green MPs. That's not going to be, we're not going to be entering government, I think, at the next general election with all of that context, two, three, maybe even four Green MPs. So yes, I do think it's likely to be a breakthrough.
Bristol obviously being one of them, where the Greens won the most votes in Bristol West in the local elections. I see a lot of people saying that, well, Thangam Debonair's majority is so big that it can't be overcome. I assume you disagree with that, because I also disagree with it, because Bristol West is such an interesting situation where it had a Conservative MP, a Liberal MP, a Labour MP, and it all was flipping back and forth so quickly. It seems as if a lot of things are changing there, which links to something you were saying about how I think hopes were dashed and how the Greens were growing until Corbyn came along. And I think Bristol is a perfect example of that, right? Where the Greens were surging in Bristol, and then 2016, the first local elections after Corbyn won, down they go. And then as soon as he goes, they start going back up again. It definitely seems as if there was a big contingent of people, and Bristol's demographics is mostly made up of those people who were just looking for something that would give them a voice. And they found it in the Greens, and then they found it in Corbyn, and now they're finding it in the Greens again. The other question I had was something that was more, you and I have known each other for like a decade at this point, I think. And I very remember very clearly about 7 years ago, you and I were sitting on a bus in the city I'm in at the moment, talking about Corbyn. I think it was after he won, or when it was obvious he was going to win. And I said I was going to join Labour, and you declined, in part because you said Labour was too dominated by right-wing MPs to be reformed. And I disagreed. I thought we could change it. And so my question is, do you think you were right?
It's a really good question.
With
I
everything that
think
happened, obviously a lot have happened, good and bad, but do you feel that that judgment you made there was right? Because I'm not sure.
so what I would say is, do I think that there is a theoretical world in which the Labour Party could be reformed, and transformed from, a party that occasionally elects a left-wing leader but fundamentally is still a right-wing party, in terms of its institutions, not necessarily in terms of its membership, or rather its infrastructure. Theoretically, yes. Do I think that that's easy? No. Do I think that my look, I don't want to be the I told you so guy, but I do think that
No, it's
the fundamentals of my doubts about the Corbyn project were right. And so I think if you look at the years that Corbyn led the Labour Party, there was the media character assassination, there was the weird and bizarre political dynamics that were created by Brexit, the inadequacies of the 2019 general election campaign, and so on and so on and so on. But I think for me, undoubtedly, one of the biggest of the reasons for the Labour Party's failure, or rather the Corbyn project's failure, was that it was a project that was sabotaged not from the outside, but from the inside. The failure, the leadership to transform the party from being a right-wing party that happened to be led by a left winger into a genuinely left-wing party was ultimately a key part of its undoing. And it's also the reasons why we've seen the gains made by the left under Corbyn so astonishingly quickly reversed under Starmer. And I think if you look at the history of the Corbyn leadership, there were two different approaches you could have taken when you seized control of the Labour Party in 2015, seek urgent internal reform to transform the party. Or you can take the approach that Corbyn did initially, which was extremely conciliatory. So you look at 2015, he appointed a shadow cabinet that broadly reflected the political breadth in the party. In his initial appointments, if I remember rightly, Andy Burnham was shadow home secretary. Now, this is the Andy Burnham of 2015 who was voting for was abstaining on benefit cuts rather than the Andy Burnham of 2022, who's the left-wing king of the north. There was a wide range of political views in that shadow cabinet. Corbyn erred away from kind of major internal party reform. He even allowed for like a diversity of opinions to be advocated by the shadow cabinet. In that period, you had leader of the opposition and the shadow foreign secretary publicly advocating two different positions on foreign policy. Now, that's how conciliatory it was that collective responsibility went out the window, and he was willing to let right wingers in the Labour Party speak publicly from a shadow cabinet position in opposition to the policy that he was pushing for. Now, how was the left rewarded for that conciliatory approach? You had the attempted coup in 2016, followed by the Owen Smith leadership campaign. You had the constant briefing. You ultimately had the breakaway of Chukwuemeka and the Change UKs, the independent groups, whatever they eventually became, which was a crucial thing. It was designed to prevent the conciliatory approach. It was supposed to prevent a right-wing breakaway group, and then it happened anyway.
But that was the thing to me is it all of that conciliation was indeed designed, as you say, to avoid a right-wing breakaway, and then it happened anyway. At which point, and I think I said this at the time as well, fine, have at it. As many of them go as possible, because we're already past the Rubicon. We've crossed the Rubicon at this point. You did everything you could, you avoided a split for 4 years, it's here. Just put the foot on the accelerator and let all of these people just walk out the door. And then replace all of them in their seats with good, strong lefties. And not all of them are going to win. Some of them, these MPs are going to run as independents, as indeed the Chuckers did. Most of the Labour lefties you put in will win. And they didn't do it, which I don't know. But it does, to play devil's advocate for a second, it does seem to me as if perhaps Corbyn was quite recognizant of the fact that he was elected leader of effectively a right-wing party. So in effect, he did actually recognize the point you made, that he has more weak within the Labour Party than he thought. And had he tried to embark on a sudden program of radical reform, like it probably would, it could have like wrecked the party instantly. So I wonder if like that was the reasoning behind it, because ironically, in the sense that you're right there, but also like one wonders what else he could have done.
Well, indeed. I mean, it was an impossible situation to be in. But I think, looking back, given the way that the Labour right behaved, we've also seen now with the leaked report, the Labour right behaved in that way, even when he was trying to preserve the broad church. Now, you're right, we don't know what would have happened if he'd have just ripped the plaster off early and, tried to, you know, for example, do all the internal party reforms that would have been needed. So things like mandatory reselection for MPs, you know, clearing, reforming both not only the leader of the opposition's office, but clearing out Southside Labour HQ of right-wing staff members, like reforming the party's democracy so that conference, the membership was in the driving seat rather than the PLP. We don't know what would have happened. Maybe a huge chunk of those of Labour MPs would have disappeared and formed a rival party. That may well have happened, but what we have instead is Jeremy Corbyn preserved the Labour Party for Keir Starmer to take over, marginalise, kick out, and purge the left. That's the result we have in terms of what that strategy did. And I think for me, there's a fundamental question here, which is, if you look at the results of the Corbyn project, it's essentially what it was, I think, was a practice run for what would happen if a genuinely left and radical government ever got elected. Because, you know, you had a left-winger elected leader of the Labour Party, failed to reform it, was undermined from within and was undermined from without. If he'd been elected Prime Minister, the forces in the state, in business, in the media would have been so much stronger. And so, you know, in terms of left strategy, if we're thinking about left strategy, I think it's that we need to think really long and hard in the future about the experience of Corbynism, about the right calls that were made, the wrong calls that were made, because, you know, if there's ever in the distant future another situation where the Labour Party is led by a left winger, they need to be learning from this. But also, if the left ever takes power in this country, we also need to be thinking about these things, because the bureaucracy of the state, the power of capital, will be doing exactly what the Labour right did to Jeremy Corbyn, but on a much bigger scale, if there's ever a left-wing government elected. And so we need to think critically about these things and to think, was that the right approach? Was that the right strategy? If you seek to take a similar strategy in government, do you end up getting a left-winger elected into, as prime minister, that essentially is just tinkering around the edges of the crises that we face rather than actually dealing with the scale of it?
It feels to me as if it's a great irony. Well, I said there's two great ironies that I think can be drawn out from the points you made. Not about you, I mean about Corbyn. That Corbyn and his allies spent a decade or two rightly objecting to Blair's government tinkering around the edges, right? And getting into power with a big majority, doing a few piecemeal things that left the British state and capitalism effectively totally intact, and then bequeathed it to the Tory party, who went ahead and kept everything bad and got rid of everything good. And then Corbyn came to the leadership of the Labour Party and he did exactly the same thing, which I just think is a truly sad and ironic situation, because he ended up preserving, as you say, the right-wing aspects of the Labour Party, and everything slightly left-wing about it was swept away because it was built on sand. And I think there's also something to tease out there about leftists preparing for power, right? Because it's still strange to me that, like, people on the Labour left, I guess they didn't think they would ever wield power because they never really thought about what they were going to do. And so there were only a few people. I remember seeing Max Shanley write about this stuff, about what you'd need to do in terms of sacking people from Southside, reintroducing mandatory reselection, restructuring Young Labour and all these things. And he seemed to be the only one actually thinking about this publicly, or indeed at all, to say this is what the Labour left needs to be doing if we want to make this a party that's actually structurally different. And there were no structural changes made. So for my final question, my last guest has left the Labour Party, very critical of Starmer, but was not interested in joining a minor left-wing party. Unlike some of the people who have formed the Breakthrough Party or the Northern Independence Party, they have not joined smaller parties. You, however, have been building a new party in the historical sense for the past decade. So I'd like to end these on a positive note. What would be your advice for lefties who have quit Labour and are looking for something sort of productive to do with their time? They're looking to put their passion to use. Is it just join the Greens, or is it something more?
Speaking about this with my hat on as leader of the Green Group on a city council, if you're looking for a way to organise, agitate and campaign for a left-wing transformation of society, then the Green Party offers you the opportunity to do just that. So if you want to see like a fundamental redistribution of power and wealth in our country and across the world, if you want to see public services run in public ownership for people, not profit, if you want a Green New Deal program of rent controls and mass social housing building, reparations for slavery and for colonialism, you want to see a humane migration policy, a repeal of anti-trade union laws, a £15 an hour minimum wage, and so on and so on and so on, you can make that happen. But it won't come from the Labour Party. It's only the Greens that are offering that problem right now. Now, that being said, respect all the people who take a different view, whether that be, the Labour Party, or whether it be throwing party politics aside altogether. I understand that there's never solely one vehicle through which we drive change and drive the change we want to see. But what I would say is whatever vehicle you do choose, make sure you choose a vehicle. So that could be the Green Party. It could be fighting from within in the Labour Party. It could be organising in the climate movement, in trade unions, in peace campaigns, in tenants unions, whatever it is. Because the truth of the scale of what we're up against is that we need to be fighting on many fronts. We need to be fighting with many allies. We need to be fighting with many, many, many people. So, we've been talking about left strategy in this conversation. I don't have all the answers to left strategy. Anyone who claims to is a liar. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been out of power for all of our lives. We wouldn't keep losing if we had the answers to left strategy. Find something new that drives you and keep pushing and keep agitating for that change. Now, from my perspective, I'm a trade unionist. I'm a grassroots activist. I'm a Green Party member and councillor. For me, all those things are valuable, and I'd encourage everyone to keep doing what they're doing, even as, we look around the world and it becomes unimaginably worse with every day that passes, seemingly, because, the tides of history move in strange ways, and, we could be having this conversation in 5 years' time under a completely new government. We could be having, we don't know what the tides of political and economic forces are going to be, but we know that they need steers and they need people fighting and pushing and struggling for the change that we want to see.
Unless you've got something you'd like to plug or say at the end.
The only thing I'd say is whatever you do, make sure you follow @LeftyStats on Twitter and subscribe to the Patreon and support everything that Stats for Lefty does. Also, check out Elle's articles on Navarra Media. They're a brilliant... they do a brilliant analysis of polls and elections and everything else. But yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to that episode of Stats for Lefties. I really appreciate you taking the time to hear what we have to say. To hear the full episode, including the fun half, sign up to our Patreon at patreon.com/leftystats. And I want to give a special thanks to the following comrades who support my work on Patreon at the £5 tier. Alan Spence, Alex Wilson, Bert Rothkugel, Chloe Hopkins, Chris Gravel, Daniel Rayner, Conrad, Michael Murray, Mick McAteer, Patrick Lefebvre, Pavel Kurjamowski, Ruth Holiday, SN, Stephen Carr, Thomas Alexander, and Juditha De Silva. Thanks very much for supporting my work, guys. I really appreciate it. Have a good day.